Hey, everybody. Tanzina Vega with you for The Takeaway on December 3rd. The impeachment inquiry in the House shifts to the Judiciary Committee, and many of you aren't sure what to expect.
This is Kate calling from Philly, and my question is, what's next? How is this different than the hearings that we've already had?
You sent us your questions, and we gave them to a constitutional law professor.
The Judiciary Committee is drawing up articles of impeachment, which will then be sent on to the entire House. So they're deciding what exactly they want to charge the president with having done.
Also on the show, the new movie Queen and Slim tells a story about Black Americans not often seen in Hollywood films.
You're a Black man that killed a cop and then took his gun.
I'm not a criminal.
You are now.
Plus, we'll check in on Iran, where protests have sparked a brutal government crackdown. But we start with impeachment and your questions. Here we go.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
This is Kate calling from Philly. And my question is, so what's next? How is this different than the hearings that we've already had?
I'm Tanzina Vega. You're listening to The Takeaway, and you've got impeachment questions, and we've got some answers, hopefully.
You have to ask me nicely.
The House Judiciary Committee will hold its first public impeachment hearing starting tomorrow. Now, last month's hearings at the House Intelligence Committee showcased high-profile witnesses taking questions from lawmakers and lawyers, but Wednesday's hearings are set to feature testimony from professors of constitutional law. And there are so few examples of presidential impeachment in our history that even though it's spelled out in the Constitution, there's still so much confusion about exactly what impeachable conduct looks like and what the framers intended when they included it in the Constitution. So, what is impeachment? Well, if you take Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's word for it, impeachment is entirely political.
Well, look, impeachment, as a practical matter, is whatever a majority of the House decides it is at any given moment.
But with no shortage of opportunities for political grandstanding, many of you, our listeners, still have questions.
I'm wondering which parts of the current impeachment process are contested by Republican lawmakers in the White House. And are the claims of the process being unfair and unjust just a smokescreen?
Hi, my name's Gerald. I'm calling from Boston, Massachusetts. And my question is, what are the actual grounds for impeachment? And what purpose does impeachment hold in a democratic process?
I'll answer the question.
Joining me now is Michael J. Klarman, a professor of law at Harvard University. Michael, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
So I don't think I'm alone when I say a lot of us are really trying to get past the politics here and to our most recent caller, Gerald, say, what exactly are the grounds for impeachment? So why don't we start there?
The Constitution provides that the president, vice president, and other civil officers of the United States can be impeached by the House and removed by the Senate for treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors. Treason and bribery are pretty straightforward. High crimes and misdemeanors was a term of art that the framers derived from British practice. It had a particular meaning, and it may sound a little counterintuitive, but it actually doesn't require a crime. It requires some sort of serious abuse of office.
And so the second part of our caller's question there was, what purpose does impeachment hold in the democratic process, which I think is a critical part of this conversation? So what purpose does it have?
There were people at the Philadelphia Convention that wrote the Constitution that objected to the idea of the president's being removable from office at all. They said, if the voters don't like the way the president's been performing, they can vote the president out at the next election. That proved to be a distinctly minority position, and an overwhelming majority of the delegates thought, well, what happens if the president becomes corrupt? What happens if the president becomes incompetent? And so they agreed pretty overwhelmingly that there needed to be some specified grounds for removing a president from office before the next election.
We started the segment with our caller, Kate, who said, I've been hearing these impeachment hearings for the past couple weeks. What is happening tomorrow that's so different? And what's happening tomorrow, Wednesday, is that the House Judiciary Committee is going to hold its impeachment hearing. We had another question from one of our listeners. Let's take a listen to what Tristan wanted to say.
Hello, this is Tristan Stario calling from Seattle, Washington. I've been following the proceedings closely, and I was wondering, What exactly is the role of the Judiciary Committee? Are they outlining process for a hearing in front of the entire House? And what are some of the most important things they'll decide?
Michael?
The hearings last week in the Intelligence Committee were gathering information about the president's phone call to the President Zelensky of Ukraine. The Judiciary Committee is drawing up articles of impeachment, which will then be sent on to the entire House. So they're deciding what exactly they want to charge the president with having done. There'll certainly be an article of impeachment about the Ukraine shakedown. There'll also probably be articles of impeachment about the president's obstructing Congress's impeachment inquiry. The president has declared in an unprecedented fashion that there'll be no cooperation between the White House or the administration and the House in these impeachment proceedings. So they've refused to make witnesses available. They've refused to provide documents. That's pretty much unprecedented in American history to the extent of refusing cooperation. There'll be an article of impeachment about that. There may be articles of impeachment dealing with obstruction of justice. These are the items enumerated in the Mueller report, the president's effort to fire the special counsel, the president's instruction to his White House counsel, Don McGahn, to lie about whether the president had tried to fire Mueller. And there might be an article of impeachment about the emoluments clause. That's the president making money every day of his presidency, which the Constitution pretty clearly does not permit. So that's for the House Judiciary Committee to decide. They'll decide what are the specific charges or articles of impeachment. That'll be, then be sent to the floor of the House, and it'll be voted on. And it looks like it'll probably be voted on by pretty much strict party lines.
Given what we just laid out in terms of the politics here and what we heard Mitch McConnell say at the top, which is impeachment is basically whatever the House wants it to be. We have this language, as you mentioned, which is really spelling out the potential reasons for impeachment, treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. Politics aside, and maybe that's not possible, but is there a legal consensus, Michael, as to what those terms actually mean? Because you just laid out a pretty hefty list of articles of impeachment that sound like all of those things potentially combined.
I think in normal political times, there would be a very strong consensus that what President Trump did in that phone call is obviously impeachable. When you go back and look at what the framers' concern was, it was really threefold. One was, we don't want corruption. And by corruption, they meant something very straightforward, which is they don't want government officials subordinating the common good to their own personal interests. The second concern was about foreign corruption, and they were very worried that a president, unlike a king, could be vulnerable to foreign corruption, foreign bribery. And the third concern was interference in American elections. So when you take those three things together, in a sense, Trump hits the trifecta. The phone call was about involving another government in American elections for the president's own personal good, not pursuing the interests of the country, which was providing the $400 million in defense aid that Congress had appropriated. We're not in normal political times. We're in extraordinarily polarized times. And the Republican Party has decided that it doesn't matter what Trump did. They're going to defend him. One way to think about this is to do a thought experiment. What if Barack Obama in the 2016 election had gone to Vladimir Putin and said, I need you to dig up dirt on Hillary Clinton's opponent, Donald Trump, and I'm willing to give you something for that. I'm willing to give you free rein in Crimea, which you've just absorbed from Ukraine, and I'm going to repeal all the sanctions against you for doing that. What would Republicans have thought? That's the rough equivalent of what Trump did in that July 25th phone call. And the answer is, of course, every Republican would be demanding the next day at the top of their voices that Obama be impeached. And when you flip the parties, unfortunately, we're not at that situation where everybody will agree this is exactly what the framers had in mind. Of course, this is a dangerous thing for the president to do. And you can't just leave it to the voters in 2020 because he's trying to corrupt the election.
Well, and that raises other questions, as we mentioned earlier, about the White House's refusal to cooperate in a lot of this investigation. And in addition, President Trump was invited to participate in Wednesday's hearings. He has declined to attend, and he has cited his obligations at a NATO meeting in Europe. But of course, the president has also called this process, as we have become very accustomed to, is saying that this is a hoax. I want to play a call from one of our listeners who has a question about this refusal to cooperate and participate.
This is Bernadette from Binghamton, New York. Since the White House has decided not to participate in this portion of the hearing, at what point are they forced to, or do you think they will choose to participate?
Michael.
I think that the White House has decided that they're not going to participate in the House impeachment proceedings because they don't want to confer any legitimacy. The Republicans will participate, and it looks like the strategy that they've decided on is, we're going to do what about this? What aboutism? They're going to focus on Ukraine, and they're going to argue that Ukraine interfered in the 2016 election to advantage Hillary Clinton. That's a ridiculous claim. There's absolutely no factual evidence, just like there's absolutely no evidence suggesting that Joe Biden did anything corrupt in Ukraine. But these are complicated stories, and Americans have very busy lives, and it's not clear that everybody can follow this in great detail and understand what's going on. So it's going to be like in 2016, where the response to everything that Trump did that seemed inappropriate was, well, what about those Hillary Clinton emails? And now the response is going to be, well, what about Ukraine's interference in the 2016 election? But there's no factual basis for this. Once this proceedings shift to the Senate, it's almost certain that the House will vote to impeach, and probably pretty much along party lines. Then it's Mitch McConnell who gets to run the show, and he can run the impeachment proceedings any way he wants. And the White House may decide that they'd prefer to participate in those hearings in the Senate, which will be a much more friendly forum for them.
I want to play one more call from one of our listeners, Ed, about the White House's participation, specifically when it comes to subpoenas.
Hi, my name is Ed from Los Angeles. I see the White House is refusing to participate in the impeachment hearings this week, claiming the process is unfair, and they have listed a number of specific complaints. I'm curious about the validity of those complaints and what might be done or what is being done to address them.
Michael.
Well, cases are being litigated in court about whether the White House has to comply with subpoenas, whether administration officials like Don McGahn have to show up for hearings. And the Democrats in the House have decided, look, we can't be fighting this out forever. They can delay this all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court term doesn't end until the summer. We're not going to allow this sort of obstruction. We're just going to go ahead and proceed, even though there's a lot of valuable testimony that might ultimately be gathered. Well, readers need to think about the argument. So the White House's argument is, we get to decide when impeachment proceedings are fraudulent, when they're a hoax. That's the same thing as saying, let's not even bother to have impeachment proceedings. That can't possibly be what the framers had in mind. It can't be that the White House gets to make a judgment. Well, we think this impeachment is a hoax and that impeachment is not a hoax. Obviously, this is for the House to decide. And never in American history has a White House made the kinds of claims they're making about no need to cooperate at all. There have always been fights over what's covered by executive privilege and what isn't. But the White House is invoking privileges that have never been vindicated by any court. Their argument is there is this testimonial privilege. Somebody close to the president, like the White House counsel Don McGahn, doesn't even have to show up. Well, that claim was just resoundingly rejected by a district court judge. But of course, the administration's going to appeal it. And if it goes all the way to the Supreme Court, the earliest it could be resolved is this summer. And it could easily go for another year or so, after which this will all be moot because we'll have had the 2020 election. So the House has plausibly determined that they're not going to allow this sort of obstruction. They're just going to go ahead. But there will be an article of impeachment about this sort of obstruction of Congress. And there has been in the past as well. There have been impeachment articles about obstruction of Congress.
Last question for you, Michael. A lot of this, what we've been trying to get to the bottom of here today, is just what exactly is impeachable conduct and what isn't? What does the Constitution say? A lot of the conversation around this topic, at least in the media, has been what Americans feel and think about this issue. How important is public opinion, particularly for the members of Congress presiding over these impeachment hearings? Are they playing to what's in the Constitution, or are they playing to whether or not they're going to be elected in the next term?
Public opinion is always critical. Abraham Lincoln said, in a republic like the United States, public opinion is the only thing that matters. One of the reasons why Republicans probably made a mistake in 1998, 1999 to try to remove Bill Clinton is that public support just wasn't there. throughout those impeachment proceedings. He had approval ratings of 65%, 70%. And the American public was just not convinced that lying about sex, even under oath, was sufficient grounds for removing the president. Public opinion matters today. If President Trump's approval ratings weren't averaging about 42%, if they were more like Clinton's approval ratings, I would be surprised if Democrats were going through with this, because the response to impeachment would be, yeah, but the public gets to have a view on this. And if they think this isn't serious enough, then maybe it'd be better to just drop this and let the voters decide. Opinion polls show that if you describe what Trump did in that phone call, you say the president tried to use his public office to pressure a foreign nation into digging up or manufacturing dirt on his political opponent, 70% of Americans say, no, that's seriously inappropriate. And there is roughly majority support for impeachment and removing the president from office. The problem is that the Republican Party responds to Republican voters, and the president is extremely popular, and something like 90% of Republicans don't think he's done anything wrong at all. So that's why the Republican Party will vote against impeachment and vote against removing him from office.
Michael J. Klarman is a professor of law at Harvard University. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. The film Queen and Slim premiered last week to viewers eagerly awaiting a classic outlaw narrative for Black audiences set against the very relevant backdrop of police brutality.
You're a Black man that killed a cop and then took his gun.
I'm not a criminal.
You are now.
That was Daniel Kaluuya and Jodie Turner-Smith in a scene from the film. The two actors star as a young couple on the run after a deadly encounter with a police officer. In the run-up to the release, much of the film's hype was centered on its star-studded Black cast and crew. The film was directed by Melina Matsoukas and written by Lena Waithe. Some Black critics, however, found that the film failed to go deep enough in examining the complicated characters at its center. But their critiques upset some fans on Twitter who were hoping that Black writers would be more supportive of a film made by Black filmmakers. For more on this conversation about Black critics and criticism, I'm joined by Angelica Bade Bastio, staff writer for New York Magazine's Vulture, and Clarkeisha Kent, staff writer at Wear Your Voice. Thanks to you both for joining me.
Thank you for having
us.
Absolutely. Angelica, let's start with you, because in your review of the film, you write that Queen and Slim favors style over substance. Where did it fall short?
In everything dealing with the script and the characterization, and in trying to deal with the complexity of the themes it was dealing with of Black love and Black resistance, it deeply failed on those levels.
Clarkeisha, how did you feel about the film? What worked or didn't work, should I say, for you?
I agree with Angelica. The characterization was really lacking. You don't really get to know them as people. Like they prematurely become these like symbols that you follow. And that's really just how the movie goes. You don't get to know them on like a very personal or intimate level.
In terms of some of the pushback on social media, Clarkeisha, what would you say about Queen and Slim that's really upset people in terms of their reactions here?
Well, it's very polarizing, very divisive. I think most agree that the script could have used another rewrite, because to me personally, it reads as a first draft. But what's upsetting, I guess, about the criticism is that I guess people were expecting, you know, I guess unilateral acceptance and a love for the film. And I'm sorry, when you're dealing with subjects like this and you're not more careful with how you render them, then yeah, you're going to get a polarizing reaction. And there are some people on Twitter that don't understand that, I guess.
Angelica, what was some of the feedback you got to your review?
Well, I think one of the most galling things I saw was being called an Uncle Tom for critiquing the film. You put a film out there in a world is going to get critiqued. I think it's very patronizing and condescending to expect Black critics to treat Black art with kid gloves.
And what does the pushback say about how Black critics are expected to approach their analysis of Black art in particular? Because we know, and of course we're having this conversation with the backdrop of lack of diversity, the backdrop of Oscars so white, the backdrop of all of these issues when it comes to representation, particularly in the media and in the arts. So the pushback is expecting what from Black critics, Angelica?
I think it's expecting support. I think there's this fear of scarcity when it comes to Black art, that if we don't support everything that comes out, we'll never see anything else, which, again, I find very patronizing. And I think that people really want to support Black art. They want to see themselves on screen, and that sometimes leads to a very basic understanding of what critics do. We're not PR people.
Karkeisha, your thoughts on that, and do you take that into consideration when you review films that are made by or for Black audiences and Black filmmakers?
Yes and no. I feel like it's something that we all just kind of have in the back of our mind, kind of innately. But like Angelica said, that doesn't mean I'm going to treat your movie like it's a Mickey Mouse Clubhouse like episode. Like, that doesn't mean I'm just going to look away. I'm not a PR person. You know, I'm a critic. At the end of the day, we love these films. We love films, period. And if we, you know, we didn't love them, we wouldn't be critiquing them. We wouldn't be saying anything. We would just let them come out and be haphazard or come out and make these weird and unforced mistakes and just say nothing and let it be that. But I think the assumption is that we say these things because we hate these films, which is a really insulting assumption. And I think that's where it's coming from. That's why the vitriol is so thick. I also think it's very gendered, and I feel like we don't talk about that as much.
Meaning that a lot of the criticism was against Black women critics, is that right?
Yes, yes.
Angelica, do you agree with that?
Oh, yes. I think, you know, being a woman critic automatically opens you up to a lot of vitriol. Being a Black woman on top of that, it opens you up even more, because I think sometimes people don't think you deserve the place you're at. And, you know, you don't look like other film critics out there. Maybe your opinions are very different because you come from a different background. And people, again, I think have misconstrued ideas about what critics are supposed to do, which is a big problem with that.
In some ways, it mirrors, to a certain extent, journalists as well, who are supposed mm-hmm. to have some sort of, I hate the word objectivity, but some sort of clarity in terms of what they're reporting on. They're not public relations folks, right? Do you both feel that sort of pressure in terms of navigating, or the pressure to say, if I write something, you know, that doesn't help, I might actually hurt the film?
Critics have a lot less power than people think. Mm-hmm. You know, if critics had that much power, then there wouldn't be a million Transformers movies out there.
Yep.
Or the Avengers movies would actually maybe be good. No offense, fans, to that.
Clarkeisha, your thoughts on that? I'm not going to touch that. I'm not a critic, so I'm not touching that.
I agree. Yeah, critics, we don't have as much power as people think. We're just literally here sharing our opinion on, you know, in the public sphere, hoping to improve these conversations and hopefully improve the films in the future. For the gender aspect, I'm so glad you mentioned objectivity, because that's a complete myth. I feel like that's a white supremacist word, but I don't have enough time to get into it. But for the gendered aspect, if you're a woman, period, on the internet especially, no one expects you to have an opinion. But if you're a Black woman, no one really, really expects you to have an opinion, and they get mad when you have one. So that's where a lot of the vitriol comes from.
I'm wondering, Angelica, your thoughts, because I think there was something interesting. Lena Waithe said on Twitter, quote, "We haven't overcome until we can have honest opinions about each other's work in public. We don't mind being a part of that shift. I'm sending love to every Black critic, whether you loved it or hated it." And I think, you know, as we get more, quote unquote, diversity in these spaces, whether it's entertainment, film, the arts, media more broadly, there is a sense that those of us who have made it, right, to this place where we can speak out and have this big public perch, are almost traitors in a way, you know, to what we're trying to break out, as opposed to, I think, white critics or white journalists or white media creators who are considered just, again, to use that word, objective observers of culture, right? Do you think that's true, Angelica, that we haven't overcome until we can have honest opinions about each other's work in public, to what Lena Waithe was saying?
I mean, I think Lena Waithe is right, although I probably wouldn't use the exact language of overcoming. But I do think that with more diversity, there's less pressure on Black critics, because there is a lot of pressure to perform in a certain way and to support Black art. And sometimes that can feel very overwhelming. Sometimes you just want to talk about art and feel like your voice is respected. But there is a lot of pressure that comes with this idea of, like, that women shouldn't really be speaking. And if you're a Black woman, it's like your voice is taken for granted in a lot of ways.
Angelica Jade Bastio is a staff writer at New York Magazine's Vulture, and Clarkeisha Kent is a staff writer at Wear Your Voice. Thanks to you both for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Much.
In Iran, a hike in gas prices has sparked the deadliest protest the country has seen since the Islamic Revolution in the 1970s. According to Iranian officials, at least 180 people were killed over a violent four-day crackdown that began 2 weeks ago when Iranian security forces opened fire on unarmed protesters. In an interview on Fox and Friends Monday morning, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo expressed support for the protesters.
We've supported those protesters. We've done our best to make sure they can continue to communicate by using the internet, which the Iranian leadership attempted to shut down in its entirety. This administration has taken a completely opposite view of the important political protests, the freedom-seeking, the freedom-loving people of Iran than President Obama and his administration did.
But the Trump administration has had a difficult relationship with Iran, including imposing sanctions on Iran's national bank in an effort to increase economic pressure on the country following attacks on Saudi oil fields this fall. Here to tell us more is Farnaz Fasihi, a reporter with The New York Times covering Iran. Farnaz, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So the protests started out as folks who were demonstrating against higher gas prices. They've now become much bigger. What was the spark that led to this becoming so charged?
There was a lot of pent-up anger among Iranians, particularly the younger generation, because of unemployment, because of inflation, and because of social oppression, and a government system that really meddles in their day-to-day affairs, from what to wear, how to think, where to go. And I think the sudden surprise increase of gasoline prices by 300% was really the last straw. It sparked first peaceful protests where people were parking their cars in the middle of the highway, or they were blocking roads and coming out. And then it very quickly morphed into demonstrations that were much bigger than the economy or gas prices and were really targeting the regime of the Islamic Republic.
The Trump administration, as we mentioned at the top, has imposed economic sanctions on Iran, particularly against the Iranian Central Bank. Can you explain how these sanctions play into the protests, if at all?
The sanctions that Washington has imposed on Iran are the harshest and most comprehensive sanctions ever placed on Iran or any other country. They've put a blanket ban on Iran's ability to sell its oil, and it was an oil-dependent economy, therefore creating a budget deficit for Iran in the coming year. One of the reasons that Iran decided to introduce this new gas policy where gasoline is rationed and then this steep price hike was because they needed to compensate for the loss of money that they were making from the oil prices and the sanctions. So sanctions have directly pressured not just the Iranian government, but the Iranian people. Having said that, we have to take sort of a step away and look at the fact that these protesters were not just coming out and complaining about the economy. If they were only complaining about the economy, you could say that sanctions played a greater role. But they were also complaining about much larger things. They were out in the street saying, we don't want an Islamic Republic. Death to the supreme leader. We want freedom. We want to just be a normal nation and live our normal lives. So you really see a particularly this younger generation, as sort of a departing from the ideologies that brought the Islamic Republic to power. And I think that's going to be very challenging moving forward for Iran. They can blame it on U.S. sanctions, on U.S. pressure and foreign instigators all they want, but until they really address the underlying causes that move people to come out and put themselves in front of bullets, this is going to go on.
We also heard at the top Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on Fox News on Monday say that the U.S. government has had a different relationship under the Trump administration with Iran and its citizens when it comes to supporting protesters compared to the Obama administration. Can you explain what he meant by that?
Well, the Trump administration's stated policy toward Iran was maximum pressure, that they would enforce these sanctions on Iran, exit from the nuclear deal, try to isolate Iran in order to push Iran to come to the negotiating table for Mr. Trump's campaign promise of having a better, wider deal with Iran, which hasn't materialized. The unstated policy of the Trump administration, we can safely say, has always been to hope that these pressures that they put on the economy would actually make the people of Iran rise up against the regime and pressure the regime, either topple it or if not topple it, at least force it to come and talk to the U.S. because they have no choice, corner them. So now that we are now at that point, right, that has materialized. But where do we go from here? The U.S. has been sending a lot of mixed messages to Iran. Yes, they say we are supportive of the protests, but they've also taken an unusually open endorsement of these protests. The special envoy for Iran, Brian Hook, said as these protests were raging, he gave an interview and said, "We are very pleased about these protests." This is language that U.S. doesn't often use about protests in other countries. They usually say, "We're monitoring it, we're watching it, or we're concerned about the crackdown." But to say that we're very pleased with the protests, or Secretary Pompeo asking Iranian protesters to send him video footage of what was going on, this puts the U.S. at the front and center of these protests, and it's a fine line to walk because then the Iranian government can say these protests are not legitimate. They are instigated and orchestrated by the U.S., and I think this is the sort of fault line here. How much do you openly support them, but how do you do that in a way that doesn't delegitimize the people's demands?
Farnaz, we've got less than a minute left, but I just want to ask about the internet blackout that happened around the time of the protests. Mike Pompeo said that the United States had helped to maintain open internet access for Iranians. What is the situation now?
The internet was completely shut down for 5 days, and then it began coming back. Some provinces still don't have internet, the ones that are along Iran's border, and there was a lot of unrest. But actually, Mr. Pompeo said that, but I did not see, actually, Iranians were calling for the U.S. to beam internet through satellite, but that didn't happen. So I'm not sure what he's referring to, because the U.S. did not restore internet for Iran during that dark period.
Farnaz Fasihi is a reporter for the New York Times covering Iran. Farnaz, thank you so much as always.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.